Hello, and welcome to the Original Content Podcast. I'm Anthony Ha.
And I'm Jordan Crook.
And we are joined once again by Anna Escher, an audience development manager at TechCrunch. Anna, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me. How's it going?
It's good. I feel good. Jordan, you feel good?
Always feel good on Friday, man.
That's right. I feel slightly less good because I have to move this weekend, which is not the most fun process, but hopefully by the time most people listen to this, I will be done and it'll be all fine.
Hopefully that should help. Does that give you hope or something? Like, hopefully yeah. By the time people are listening to this, that part of my life is over, as though recording it now and then listening to it later just erases the idea of you moving at all.
Right, but there's like an end point of like by like Sunday night, one way or another, this will mostly be over. But in the meantime, we are going to talk about The Inventor, which is the HBO documentary about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. Before we get to that, I have been instructed to share a little promotional message with you, our loyal listeners, which is that Extra Crunch, hopefully you've all heard of it, but if you haven't, it gives everyone access to in-depth coverage of how startups become successful, challenges facing the startup community, enhanced reader tools on the TechCrunch website, member-only conference calls, and more. If you are listening to this podcast, you get access to a promo code which will give you 20% off an annual membership plan. That promo code is original. So go to techcrunch.com/subscribe and enter the promo code ORIGINAL, and that'll give you a 20% discount on the annual membership plan. So we are trying to lock you in there. That's it. I think this is the first time I've had to read a commercial live on the podcast.
How did it feel?
It felt great. It felt like, you know, we're going to be rich today. It felt great.
It sounded like it felt great. It sounded good. Yeah,
thank you. Thank you very much.
the code original to me is like having a password. It's like, it's like, use this original promo code to get 20% off. The code is original.
Probably most of our listeners realize this, but the reason they have these promo codes is not because they're supposed to be super secret or anything. It's just so they can track who's actually driving money. So that's the reason to use the promo code.
I understand that, Anthony.
Anthony, don't tell our audience dev secrets, man.
You're also
that was for our listeners.
It's about
that was for our listeners.
Whatever.
I'm sorry.
My whole like feelings on it have just been lost in the wind. Let's just move on.
I explained the joke. I just
other things.
Okay.
My sales. Let's never do like a duo comedy routine. Let's just promise ourselves.
What are you talking about? I think we do great. All right. So we have Queer Eye season 3. You guys have been watching it. I have not yet caught up. How's that going?
I'm shocked that you haven't caught up, Anthony, just because you're normally such a diligent watcher of shows in general, and you just finish them out throughout all of their seasons.
That's true. As soon as they come out, I watch them completely in order. I'm completely caught up, and that's how I roll. But this one time, I decided to drive Jordan crazy by not doing
it. One time? Okay. Well, anyway, so Queer Eye season 3. Anna, have you watched like all of Queer Eye?
Yeah, I
have.
What
do you think of the new season?
I think it's fantastic. Like, every episode is just an emotional roller coaster, and I'm all for it.
Yeah, I was reading something recently that was talking about, I don't want to like misquote it, but it was essentially talking about how like by not making every episode Queer Eye for the straight guy and like including other people in it, that it's good in a lot of ways, obviously, but that it also like takes accountability off of like straight white men, essentially, who like don't think they need to care for themselves, like clean themselves and buy their own clothes and cook their own food, yeah, et cetera. Sure. So I just thought that was an interesting point of view.
Yeah, I think it's kind of sending the message that it's not just like straight guys that needs self-love. It's like, oh, there are so many other types of people from all over the country who, you know, could use some self-love and some positivity in their life that can go a long way. So yeah, no, I agree with that. I think it's cool that they've kind of diversified the people who are being featured on the show. I think my favorite episodes are the Jones Barbecue. Have you seen that one?
Yeah, I saw that one.
Yeah, it's great. I've been hearing that they have actually been distributing a ton of the barbecue sauce now, and a bunch of people are buying it. It was trending on Twitter. Like, I'm glad to hear that that's taking off.
Yeah, I heard that they did really well as well. But I think, like, this post that I was talking about – here, I'll send it to you. It's on Jezebel or The Muse or both. It's both is in the in the URL. But it's
– Well, I think The Muse is, like, a subsite of Jezebel or something like
that. Right. Yeah. Well, they're both – I thought they were both under the Gawker umbrella, but they're –
That's the beauty of the internet, just confusing as hell.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know who wrote what.
Like, oh my God,
it was a crossover writer or something.
Oh my God. But, interesting.
But it essentially says that, like, in widening the scope, here, I'll just read it. And in widening the scope of the Fab Five's reign, the show implies that straight men who have lived their lives under the weight of heteronormative expectations are no longer relevant in terms of fixing, even though masculinity is still one hell of a drug in 2019. And just to cite everything, mm-hmm. Hazel Sills wrote that, not me. And that's on The Muse and or Jezebel. But yeah, I just thought that was an interesting take that, like, in making it more inclusive, it kind of takes some of the accountability off of straight white guys to step up to the plate in terms of, like, what. And it also, like, kind of, I don't know, I think it's interesting, and I think, like, it's easy to get, like, super nitpicky with stuff like this, and that generally Queer Eye is, like, a feel-good show that, like, you know, encourages us to take care of ourselves and, like, present ourselves as the best possible version of who we can be and, like, what that can do for your life. And that's overall really great. And generally I find that group pretty cute and fun to watch, particularly JVN. I think he's just so lovable. So it's just, like, more of the same. I find that I'm, like, and I find this is true with a lot of, like, Netflix shows, especially, like, in that kind of vein, that it becomes, like, numbing, especially when it's, like, so frequent. Like, I'm not nearly
because it's coming out twice a year now.
Yeah, I'm not nearly as, like, tear jerky about it as I was season one, and season two was like that too. I was, like, less, like, I could have, like, teared up in every episode of season one. I'm pretty sure that it was just, like, a steady stream of, like, being emotionally tapped by that show. And season two was like, yeah, it's definitely making me have feels, but, like, not quite like last time. And then this season was like, well, this is good.
Yeah.
Good for everybody.
Yeah. Everyone's happy.
But, like, not necessarily, like, emotionally stimulating, I guess, but.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe that's I would agree with that. Maybe I'm just a monster for content.
Well, it does make me wonder about, like, how far, you know, like, even, so I've seen the first two seasons and that, like, that they're pushing against the formula in some ways, but you can still see the formula, and that the first time you watch an episode, it's really powerful. And that's not to say that the further episodes that you see can't still affect you, but you're also just more aware of the formula, and you're more aware of, oh, okay, this is the part where they have a personal soul-searching conversation. Oh, this is the part where this happens. And so in some ways, the bar gets higher for it to really affect you and surprise you.
Well, I will say, though, that, like, certain characters have become far more, like, cast members have become far more lovable to me. Like, I think in the beginning, I really didn't enjoy Bobby that much, and I cared a lot. I liked Tan, you know, and I thought Anthony was really cute because he was so emotional. Like, he was always so, like, moved by everything. And I liked Karamo a lot because I, like, liked what he did. But, like, as the show has progressed, I actually am, one, liking Bobby a lot more, mostly because when it comes down to it and you're no longer like emotionally tapped the same way by these things, Bobby is actually like the creative problem solver who like turns it into a home makeover show. And you're like, wow, he really did that with that. That's great. You know, like it's like down to an informational level. He's good. And so I ended up liking him a lot more. Karamo, I've liked less and less. Like the more I watch, the more generic he is.
Yeah. Why do you think that is?
It's so like, you know, oh, you have trust issues. Let's do trust falls. Like you know what I mean? It's like so cookie cutter, you know, like you build up walls and you need to like knock them down so you can meet new people. And he's like, okay, well here, build this wall and then knock it down. It's like so on the nose.
It's obviously harder though than the others. Like he has to, you know, go with what is in that city and like be super creative about, you know, what is actually there and how they can be like more culturally centered or whatever is like,
well, it's supposed to be like emotional wellness and stuff. And like, I don't know what Karamo got up to between the real world and Queer Eye. Maybe he's like a licensed psychologist. Maybe he is. Maybe he's like super qualified for this gig and stuff. But part of me just feels like, and I really like Karamo. Like I think what he says, even though it's generic, like what he says is right. And I think he's coming from a good place. So I'm not saying like I don't like Karamo. I just am saying that like the parts of the show with Karamo in them to me have become like less interesting to watch because I just feel like maybe it's not Karamo, but maybe it's just the problems themselves are so generic. It just feels like all very obvious. And I wish there was something just like a little bit deeper there in those bits, you know?
Well, it seems like they're in some ways like common problems, but then also that they're problems that can't really be solved in a lot of cases. Like the real answer in a lot, again, not speaking so much about season three, but just the two seasons I've seen, like that they're problems that are solved over time, probably by like years of therapy. And so to try to like come up with one activity and, you know, some other conversations and things like that. But that a lot of times it centers on this one activity to try to like crack that issue seems increasingly kind of silly.
Yeah, especially when like 99% of that quote issue is like self-confidence. Like that's something that you... Also, to be like, if we're getting really into the nitty gritty, like, in my opinion, self-confidence doesn't just come from like the finished package of working on yourself, but like actually working on yourself, like doing the actual work. Like if you want a nicer apartment, like doing the work to like understand what that looks like and what that means and like putting that time in. Or if you want a new wardrobe or you want better skin or better hair or you want to like do those things. If you want those things, like the journey to getting there and understanding it is what creates that confidence just as much as what you look like in the mirror or what your house looks like. And like by coming in and kind of doing the heavy lifting, they almost like, I would be interested to see like Queer Eye visits 5 years later and see how many people's houses and lives really feel like they've, you know, changed. Like, are they back into gym shorts and not, you know, making food and eating donuts? Or are they like, you know, do they still have it? I would be interested because it's possible that confidence only lasts as long as the cameras are gone. And then when their apartment or their house becomes a mess and their clothes get stained, they don't know what to do, you know?
Yeah, that's fair. Didn't you just redo your apartment too? Yeah.
I mean, I'm still in the process. I like naively thought that I could do everything that I wanted to do in a month. And that was like January 1st with Marie Kondo. So I'm very far along. I would say I'm like 80-ish% done, but there's definitely some stuff left to do. Like for example, there's so much stuff under my bed. I don't know. I moved in this place like 4.5 years ago. Like, I don't know what's under there. I think there's a rug. I think there's like pictures.
A baby.
I think there's a bunch of electronics actually. I think there's like a full Xbox system back there, like an old one, like an Xbox 360.
Probably, like all the cords.
Yeah, with all the cords and stuff. And I don't know what else. It could be anything. I bet there's shoes and socks and like the usual culprits, you know, but I've definitely got to figure that whole world out in there. And I was actually thinking last night about like changing up the furniture in my bedroom, but that's a whole nother endeavor. I'm going to have to think more on that. So that's what's up.
Cool. Should we talk about the inventor?
Sure.
How about we've talked about what's underneath Jordan's bed?
I mean, we could. I mean, we could like, but I just figure, you know, it's either pivot or we like go under and like start just, you know, describing what's there.
Let's pivot and then I'll update you guys once I actually get that job done. That's going to take like all of the strength that I can muster to not procrastinate on. Like that's one of those things that I could live forever with all that shit under my bed, technically, you know?
So this is like a way of sort of publicly holding you to account.
Yeah, kind of. I'm like announcing to the world. I mean, you guys can't do anything about it. You're not going to come. You're not going to come force me. But it does help, I guess, a little bit. I don't know. Anyways, let's do the pivot, though. Inventor. Elizabeth Holmes. Fraud. Let's do it.
Right. So, I mean, obviously, we all followed this to an extent in the sense that we all work at TechCrunch and are interested in tech news and Silicon Valley. But I'm curious, like, how much of the story of Theranos were you guys familiar with going into the movie?
I think I understood it from, like, the funding side. I just remember always hearing, like, oh, yeah, Theranos has raised X amount. This investor went in. She appeared at Disrupt. And we kind of saw it from, like, the tech side, but not so much, like, what was actually going on inside the company. So, yeah, I knew kind of, like, the main points, but... Right. It was definitely illuminating in some other ways, I thought.
No one knew, and except for the people who were in there and, you know, John from the Wall Street Journal, really what was going on behind the scenes. But, I mean, before watching The Inventor, I knew at least I had listened to The Dropout, and I had obviously read and followed along after the Wall Street Journal story broke. Much more, because health tech isn't really my jam. So I did know that, like, oh yeah, Theranos, and like knew it was a big deal and kind of knew the general premise of what they promised, but it wasn't in my orbit really all that much until that story broke. And then it kind of became a focal point for, I think, everyone for a while as that drama drew out, and then kind of like felt like a bit of a hibernation there. We all like remember it, like came, it stays as like a reference, you know, when you feel like maybe you're getting snake oiled a little bit. I think, like, you know, you hear like, remember Theranos, or like, even especially with like med tech and health tech and biotech, yeah, we're all, yeah, like a little bit, I think we're a little bit more cautious now, you know, because like people making claims. We're not,
I hope so.
I mean, many of us in the media are not doctors, at least. And you could say the same thing for a lot of VCs. Now, VCs who are investing in health tech and biotech tend to have more resources for due diligence and, you know, tend to have some expertise in that field. But I think it's like been a reference point. But then all of a sudden, like this past few months, there's been so much content. Well, Bad Blood came out. That was a huge, like, New York Times, yeah, bestseller. Yeah. And then there was The Dropout. There was The Dropout series on ABC alongside the podcast. There was this HBO documentary, The Inventor. And then there's also a Jennifer Lawrence movie on the way, which I am just...
I'm so excited
to see Jennifer Lawrence not blink. I think that's so funny. There's actually like a really funny like picture of her from like some movie premiere where she was really drunk, and so she was like holding her eyes super wide open.
Oh no.
Because she was like worried she was gonna look drunk for all the red carpet photos. And later, like, Ellen showed her the picture on like an interview, and Jennifer Lawrence was like, dude, I was wasted, and I was like trying to make sure I didn't look drunk, so I ended up looking like super psycho,
even weirder.
And then that's just like the only thing that I can see when I think of this movie, which is so weird and funny. I'm sure it'll be like less intense than that picture, but those are some thoughts. Picture. Yeah, you do need to Google it, Anna. It's like the funniest picture. It's one of her like more intense movies. It might have been like Red Sparrow or something. So it's like this crazy black, leather outfit with her hair like super blonde, like up in a high ponytail and like the blackest eyeliner, like super thick eyeliner.
Oh god, she looks great, but also like
it's so funny. And that's how I imagine her playing Elizabeth Holmes, like her super low voice. Yes. She's gonna be perfect for that.
That's gonna be interesting. I feel like the story's being like overtold though. There's like all these podcasts about it and like a movie and an HBO show and I don't know, it's like do you feel like it's
what can death? Bring something new to light? And I feel like unfortunately this HBO documentary, so I didn't see The Dropout on ABC, and that would probably be its closest competition plus that podcast in terms of just people's attention on this story. And unfortunately I think HBO is a couple days behind The Dropout, if I am correct. And so I don't know if that helped, but I do, and I don't know which was better, but I do know that I liked the HBO one. I listened to The Dropout podcast, and even knowing the story, I would have watched this anyway. I think it's like one of those stories that's like fascinating to see and hear from different perspectives. And also, like, I have no idea how HBO got all that footage. Like, no, what the hell? Was like, how did they get all of that? They had so much footage of like the building, and I realized that some of it was like reenactment stuff, you know, but it was interesting. There were so many.
It seemed like,
go ahead.
There was like a lot of stuff that was shot first, like for this commercial that Errol Morris made, and maybe for some other like marketing materials. And somehow they got a hold of it.
Use
all of that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny because I think in a lot of ways the documentary reminded me of the Netflix documentary Fire, about the Fire Festival. I mean, both of them are about sort of these things, you know, these sort of hoaxes and everything, but also that. In both cases, sort of the central perpetrator, or you know, the kind of the anti-hero, the villain, was not interviewed for them, but they still have this incredible presence because there's so much behind the scenes footage, which I don't understand how they got, but like that you never feel like having a standard, you know, post-mortem interview with Elizabeth Holmes would have made a huge difference to this documentary. It seems like I still don't completely understand her, but like she still has a huge presence in the film.
Yes. And I do think it would have been nice. I mean, I think whoever ends up getting the first real post-mortem interview with Elizabeth Holmes, that will be very interesting. Cause I think at the end of the day, I mean, the question that my sister asked me, my sister loves all this stuff, and she watched the Fire Festival thing too. And she was like, she was like, the question is, do they know that they're lying to people? And do they know that they're like, are they really evil in their hearts that they're like, I'm willing to do whatever it takes for me to keep my power and me to keep this facade of this lifestyle up, and I'm like ruthless in it? Or do they like believe that they are capable of solving these problems without anyone being the wiser? Like, do they believe that they can kind of always cover their own back and always kind of save the day and pull a miracle out of their pockets? And like, my belief is that it's probably a combination of both. I think it's like 90% of the time they believe they can solve the problem, and they have like cold sweats in the middle of the night being like, oh my God, I'm never going to be able to do this. Like, I'm a huge fraud and liar. Like, and then push that back down into, you know, like the black part of your heart. But it would be interesting to know that. It would be interesting to ask Elizabeth Holmes that.
Yeah, I mean, remember the part with Dan O'Reilly explaining that like Matrix experiment dice game, where I guess the outcome was that they did the study and found that the people who believed that they were doing the right thing or that the money from the test was going to go to charity, they were more inclined to cheat. So it's like, if you believe that you're doing the right thing, you're more inclined to lie about it. I thought that was, that explained the whole situation really well.
And you lie more effectively too, is that they could actually pass a lie detector test because they didn't feel like they were doing anything wrong.
Guilt for breaking the rules if it was in the service of a greater cause.
Right. Yeah. I think something, my friends have been talking about it, and the people who I've spoken with who've watched it have been asking is, do you sympathize with Elizabeth Holmes? And also in that context, do you sympathize with Billy McFarland? You know, like, or what are do with either of them, and why?
Who I sympathize with more are the people who are like two or three levels below them and who still on some level engaged in deception. And still, you know, knew that something was wrong before people on the outside knew. And I mean, and it's in the case particularly of Theranos, some of them became, you know, crucial whistleblowers. But even beyond that, I think that, that you get this insight into the process of, okay, they're telling me that this is all going to work out. I guess I've heard other stories where there's a little bit of, you know, lying to the outside world while you're trying to get everything in order. And that's just how these things work. And you convince yourself it's all going to work out. I mean, I think it's in some ways a similar psychological process, but it's a lot more relatable and less damning when it's not the main person driving the hoax, but someone who sort of gets caught up in it and in some ways is perpetuating it, but isn't the main villain.
Yeah. I have a lot of sympathy for people who are exploited by these people, like the Bohemians and Fire Festival. And like, I mean, it's arguable how much the people working on Fire App knew about the festival, but you know, benefit of the doubt, if they didn't know anything, I feel really bad for them. They spent 18 months working at a startup, excited about what they were building, only to have it all torn down in a week. And I feel sympathy for people who kind of bought into Theranos, not necessarily all of the investors, because I think it's their job to be more cautious than aggressive. I know like some people disagree with that and think VC should take risks and stuff like that. But I think that they appoint the people who shape the future. And if they choose poorly, we're all fucked. So I don't have much sympathy for many of the people in the Theranos story, to be frank, just because I just think it's like kind of some of the things that are wrong. Like I had a startup, some of the things that are wrong with Silicon Valley and startup nature. Like I had a conversation with a startup recently, and I'm not going to name who it is, but they were talking about how they pivoted and they, you know, their last thing wasn't successful and they had just hacked their way to like essentially their tech wasn't real. They were just making phone calls and placing, you know, orders manually to do something. Yeah. And it just, you know, and they had pivoted that business isn't a real thing anymore. And they were like talking about like, yeah, we did the lean startup thing and we, you know, we're doing a lot of research, and just the way that they were talking about it, just they technically weren't doing anything illegal. You know, maybe, I don't know what they were. I don't know if they had VC investment in that first company or not, but whatever. But the point is that like, that's kind of a mentality of like, you know, we'll hack it together to make it as this power player in the tech world. And I just don't really like that. And that feels like even taking a job at Theranos and knowing nothing, like those people that took those jobs even like, and knowing nothing and then seeing how poorly it was failing and kind of like keeping that quiet other than the folks who were whistleblowers. I just feel like that's, yeah, it's your livelihood. I get it, but I don't know. I don't know how you can, I don't know. I don't have a lot of sympathy for it. I'm not saying it's an easy choice or an easy position in life to be in, but
yeah, there's just a level of responsibility that should exist if you're going to be a founder and you're going to start something and grow an idea and grow a business. And the backing just like wasn't there for them. There was no medical professionals on their board. What I thought was interesting too, that I didn't know before, is that she was romantically involved with Sunny. I didn't know that.
What a weird
couple. Sunny, yeah. Oh, yeah, that was very odd. I mean, heart wants what it wants, but I was surprised by
I
that.
Have to say, though, I was having another conversation where I was just saying that I think Elizabeth Holmes, if her voice is not really that low, and if, like, that was what... If her whole thing was truly as, like, architected as it seems, then I actually do think she's, like, kind of a genius. Like, maybe an evil genius, but, like, really? Yeah, like a legit genius, because what she crafted into was, like, this... Well, like, she clearly is smart enough to fake her way through knowing how to build something like this. You know, like, you have to give her credit for that. But then also, like, her look is, like, she's pretty, but she's not, like, over-imposingly pretty, and she's clearly very smart, and she has this, like, low voice that I think immediately, like, the old white guys that she's pitching to, these, like, ancient people, are, like, immediately taking her more seriously, right, in this, like, lower register. I don't know. I just think the whole thing, like, kind of is, like, pretty – I'm impressed by it, even though I think it's – abhorrent. Yeah. I'm very impressed by what she was able to do.
If that is indeed what's going on.
One of the things about that when we were talking earlier about, like, you know, the adopting of this Silicon Valley mentality, and one of the points that the movie tries to make is to put her in the context of Silicon Valley culture, and to say, on the one hand, this is a lot worse than I mean, I think with a software startup, you can make the argument that in a lot of cases, it's sort of victimless crimes. I mean, the investors maybe lose money, like, but I'm not going to cry too much
or something. But it's not like people's lives hanging in the balance.
Right. And then I think, you know, I don't think it's actually victimless, but, like, I think the scale of, you know, what when things go south in various ways is not as bad as here, where it's like, oh, if the fake it till you make it mentality has real consequences for people's health and for people thinking that they're sick or thinking that they're okay and they're not and getting these faulty results and all of that. So to try to, like, take something that arguably makes sense for a software startup and then importing it into this health, this world of medicine, I think that's part of what the movie's trying to trace out, is to say that it's way worse here, but also that there's a philosophical connection, which I think is obvious that we can all see, but that's part of what makes it really interesting.
For sure. I think it's, like, the different industries that these startups are pushing up against, whether it's, like, health tech or, you know, Airbnb or whatever, like, regulatory industry that they are trying to change. If it's something where people's lives are affected, like health, you know, it's not somewhere where you can operate at the speed of, like, some Silicon Valley software company. Like, it just can't work like that. And I think that
I don't remember if this was the documentary or in The Dropout, but they said something about, like, no one has ever won the Nobel Prize in medicine below the age of 65 or something. And
I don't think that was in this one. I think that
might have been in The Dropout, podcast. And I might be getting it might have been, like, one person or something, or maybe it's the age of 60. I don't really remember. But the point was that, like, people don't revolutionize medicine at 19. Like, they just don't do that because medicine, in order to be revolutionized, needs to be fully understood first. And if you don't fully understand it, you can't revolutionize it. And it takes 20 years to fully understand it, right? So, like, there are people – you don't – and I'm not saying that there can't be, like, wunderkinds and that the good doctor isn't real, but, like, you know, it's the good doctor isn't real, and, you know, that doesn't happen, right? And neither was Theranos. So it's like, I don't know, that was an interesting piece of it. And the other piece that I wish that the documentary had focused on more, and something that really interests me, is, like, the domino effect that happened with the board of directors and the people who actually invested and, like, backed her, and, like, how,
right,
like, she, it was part her and part their own fault for, like, trusting one another. But, like, you know, it's easy to do when someone that, like, you respect or you trust, like, gives their stamp of approval to something, says, oh, this is okay, you, like, kind of trust that they know what they're talking about and that they checked everything. And so it's easier for you to be lazy about it, right? And like, you could see how she kind of like took advantage of that. And I would have been more interested to hear from some of those people and maybe something a little bit more scientific on how that, how those things work out. But I just thought that was really interesting.
You know, watching the documentary reminded me of, you know, my own response when some of the initial reporting about Theranos came out, because it was also a reminder of how, and they talk about this a little, that the headline of the initial Wall Street Journal story is not this crazy inflammatory thing. It was just like, Theranos is having some trouble with blood testing. And I remember at the time thinking like, wow, it seems like people are making a big deal about this story that isn't necessarily making these super damning charges about Theranos. And that was because it was very carefully reported and they were very careful about what they felt comfortable putting in print and not putting in print.
Well, and we know now that they had like lawyers down there. So they had to be super careful about what they said.
But also just that idea of how you can go from just like an initial story that just says, hey, we have some questions. There are people who have some questions. Some things aren't working, you know, exactly as they claim. There's definitely some level of dishonesty, and realizing that, not that you can always assume this is the case and you shouldn't necessarily jump to conclusions, but that there is a little bit, can be a little bit of an iceberg where the problems that you can see on the surface often imply that there's this whole other, you know, mass of shit below. It's a confused metaphor, but I'm going with it.
Right. Well, where there's smoke, there's fire is the general premise.
Yeah. And I felt, I mean, it made me feel a little sheepish of like, I remember the time being like, oh, like, it seems like this is just normal startup issues. Like, I'm sure like, you know, they'll be embarrassed, but in a year, they'll still be like this hot shit company. And boy, was I wrong.
I think a lot of people felt that way. I mean, they did that montage, right, where she was talking to the press about, my uncle got skin cancer and, you know, later it was brain cancer. And the story she tells over and over again, and they start zooming out, and you see that she said that like 150 times or something. And I think a lot of us felt, I think everyone in the media and probably a lot of people, that's the thing with fraud, right? You like, they're tricking so many people. It's on such a mass scale, this trick. And so we all feel stupid for having missed it, you know, like, or feel a little bit like we bought into something that we shouldn't have. And that's another just like layer of the pain that's caused by this kind of thing, you know?
Right. And like, I think in some ways it's a healthy instinct in that it makes you a little bit more skeptical the next time, which, I mean, and a certain degree of skepticism is healthy. I think it also, because of that, it also made some people resistant to admitting they were wrong. And there's like this amazing story about like how one of the main whistleblowers is the son of George Shultz, who's this major, you know, figure in international relations and US politics. And he became, you know, was one of these people who knows nothing about medicine and became a board member at Theranos. And his son ends up working there, and I'm sorry, grandson, and ends up working there and becoming one of the main whistleblowers. And there's this, it like takes that, even when his grandson is like, has saying, I work there and I know that this is bullshit. And you know, apparently George Shultz is still like, no, I've talked to Elizabeth and she's convinced me that this is the real deal. Like, how long it took some people to admit that they were wrong. And, you know, even outside the documentary, thinking about some of the investors who still like, you know, even as the company was going down in flames, we're still like, all you guys are haters. You know, at some point you're going to realize what an amazing technology this was. And it's just really amazing to see how deep that self-deception can go. And I think one of the things that's important to remember is like, is I do agree that we started out by talking about that question of, to what extent are they like willingly, you know, lying to people, and to what extent are they like a little bit more better intentioned, and they think they can sort of close that gap between, you know, their promises and reality at some point. And I think that, you know, that you can recognize how people can trick themselves, but also be like, man, like, this has such bad consequences for so many people. And I think the documentary does a pretty good job of laying a lot of that out. One thing I'm curious what you thought of is I think with a lot of these movies, there's this attempt to try to tell the specific story and connect it to these broader themes. Did you guys feel like it was effective at sort of both, you know, telling the Theranos story, but also trying to make this maybe some broader philosophical points about what it means?
Yeah, I think they did a good job of like explaining Theranos in the context of Silicon Valley and what it's like to have an office on Page Mill Road and have all of that security and talk about their funding and all of that. But I'm not really sure that that extends beyond just like, oh, what's it like to run a top secret company in Silicon Valley?
Right.
Yeah. I almost like, I don't know. I think it's easy as people, as like mainstream media moves more and more towards talking about the tech world and like all of the drama involved in it and these new kind of like tech celebs. I think it's easy and kind of like just almost a trap for them to want to tell us these lessons that we've kind of already learned if we've been in the industry for a long time, like these kind of very obvious extrapolations. And mm-hmm. in that way, yes, it was effective probably. I probably would have just rather it been all about the Elizabeth Holmes story and her kind of, I would have loved to hear about her dog. Like, I'm interested in those details, like just the weird off the wall stuff, but I'm like a junkie for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it brings up this whole idea of how much people idolize tech CEOs and how we put a lot of fear and faith in those leaders when we should not be, because they're people and they're flawed. Exhibit A, Theranos.
Well, and how much they idolize themselves. Wasn't there something in the documentary about like how crazy you have to be an entrepreneur in the first place?
I think so. There's or some, maybe that some the yeah, dropout. There's like some like a certain level of like about just like crazy confidence, essentially. Right.
Yeah. It's like what it takes to be, it's like the same kind of people that like run for president. It's like, what kind of person do you have to be to think that your idea is worth other people's money and that like you're capable of building something that big from scratch and, you know, that you're capable of doing the hardest job in the world, you know, like what makes you think yeah. that you can do that? And like, it's a certain kind of person, like almost a little like dangerously arrogant. But sometimes that works out really well. And sometimes they're like really grounded, amazing people who are just know that they can do it. And that's great. But sometimes it does end up being like these kind of kooky people. And that's when it's that level of arrogance is dangerous.
And I think there's also this other category. And part of what allows people to get away with this is you have these crazy kooky people who happen to make lots of money for their investors. And so everyone thinks, oh, I need to be like insane and, you know, an asshole and not care about people's personal lives or not care about, you know, like what is like a normal work-life balance or anything like that. And just kind of, or just reality. And just that when people talk about Steve Jobs in particular, who obviously is an inspiration for Elizabeth Holmes, like that it's in some ways fixating on like the negative stuff, but saying, well, it like worked out really well for him. And so like, I've got to be like that because, you know, we talk about him so admiringly because he was an asshole, but he accomplished all these things.
Right. And so everybody thinks that those things are like mutually, they're like necessary, right? You have to, in order to be like an amazing, you know, innovator and inventor the way that Steve Jobs was, like you also have to be an asshole to everyone who works with you. And like, you know, you see some of that mirrored in some of the people at the top now, you know, like Travis Kalanick was a, you know, not a very nice guy. He had a pretty bad reputation. And there are a handful of others, right, that are kind of at the top now that are not necessarily seen as being the easiest to work with. And you know that has like a trickle down effect, right? Even to like startup founders I talk to now, where they're like, oh, Steve Jobs or like Evan Spiegel or like even Elon Musk, right? Like, I don't know much about what it's like to work with Elon Musk. I imagine it's incredibly demanding given he seems like a real perfectionist, but you know, it's not necessarily like, I wouldn't be proud if he was my son, fully proud. I'd be like, Yeah, I'd be half proud, and then I'd be like, but I'm also really disappointed in you, Elon.
And I mean, not going into anything that hopefully will get me into trouble, but like, I do know people who've worked for him, and I think he also has a very healthy respect for his own capabilities and for his ability to push people to do things beyond what is realistic. And so that he also likes to overpromise and then push people to get to that point, which sometimes happens and sometimes doesn't. And I think that is, I mean, I'm not saying that that never delivers results, but it just obviously has this tremendous human cost.
Yeah, that can be a disastrous way to run a company.
Yeah, especially for the people who are under that pressure, right? Like, it's like, I'm sure that doesn't like inspire like love from his employees, you know? Like, watch a press conference or like see on his Twitter that he promises this or that, you know? And you're like, okay, well, that's not possible. But
Jordan, since you're the one who seems like you've at least dipped into some of this other content around Theranos, besides just, you know, just reading the headlines, did you feel like if somebody came to you and said, I have like a vague idea of what happened with Theranos, but I want to kind of do a deeper dive, would the inventor be the thing that you recommend for them to do that?
Yeah, probably, because it's like super visual. It covers all the bases, like the most important ones at least. And it's like the most bang for your buck. It's the most information that you'll get for in that time frame. Depending on how fast of a reader you are, but I don't think you can get through bad blood in 2 hours. So
yeah,
that's the way I do it. And then probably the book, you know, everybody, the book is really thorough and very good. So, that would probably be the number one source if you have unlimited time, but bang for your buck is this documentary. And it is a great documentary, even as a compliment, I think. So don't sleep on it.
Anna, what are your feelings about it?
Yeah, I think I haven't read Bad Blood, but I think that if you want to get the basics and learn a little bit more about who Elizabeth Holmes is and what drives her and, you know, just get deeper into the story, I think it's a good documentary to check out.
Anthony, did I talk about Madeleine McCann last time?
No, for a second I thought you did, but I realized we'd been slacking about Madeleine McCann, but I don't think we talked about it on the podcast.
Did you see any of that, Anna?
No. What's going on?
It's crazy. Do you know about it, Anthony?
No. I mean, only like, I think I looked it up when you slacked me, but I don't know like the details.
So like in 1999, this little girl was abducted. She was three years old from her bed in the like a condo, like a resort condo in Portugal. Her family is British. She's British. And like the Portuguese authorities and all this stuff got involved. And then they thought it was the parents for a while. And then they decided it wasn't the parents. And she's still missing. They've never found her. And I saw a bunch of people on Twitter being like, you know, this documentary is so stupid because it doesn't have anything new in it. Like, it doesn't have an interview with the McCanns. It doesn't have like anything new in it. It's just going over all this stuff. But like, I feel like there's a whole generation of people. Like, I didn't know anything about this Madeleine McCann girl. Now I'm like on the lookout. Like, they showed a picture of her at the end where like what she would look like if she aged, because it's been like 13 or 14 years or something. And I'm going to find her. I'm looking for her.
Oh, yeah.
It's intense.
Yeah, this is my next one I need to watch on Netflix.
I feel like it's for all the people who don't know what the hell the Maddie McCann thing is. It's like, it's crazy and really intense. And
what's it called?
Really sad for Maddie McCann. It's called The Disappearance of Madeleine McCann. It's not a Netflix original. It's like CNN or something, but it's on Netflix now. And I thought it was good. People who are familiar, like who followed along and have like known about this for the last 13 years are like really pissed about it because it's a huge thing. Like, it's a huge mystery. It's kind of like, you know, in like 20 years from now, if like people still hadn't solved like Stephen Avery's case, like the news like just keeps trickling out and people still like don't really know what the hell happened to this little girl. And it's like this huge mystery that people want to unpack. And so when a documentary came out, everybody thought like, oh, there's going to be new evidence so we can figure out like what happened to Maddie. But like they didn't. They were just like, here's what we know. People were like, okay. But anyways.
Thanks for that. Yeah. It's the same with like the Serial podcast too. It's like that there's like now there's a show about that too, but there's new information.
I've been watching that. Have you been watching, Anna?
I've watched the first episode.
That's pretty good. There's only one left.
Yeah.
Connecting it back for a second to the adventure was that Alex Gibney, the director, he actually directed this documentary about Steve Jobs a couple of years ago, which I got to interview him about. And one of the things he was very sensitive to was this idea of, are you bringing new information to light? Like, is there a scoop in the film? And I think his argument is essentially that, you know, maybe occasionally he does it, but that's not necessarily the point of his documentaries. And that's not necessarily the main reason to watch documentaries. It's not necessarily for the person who's followed every single, you know, development and knows all the details, but is more about giving an overview for the people who want to understand it, who want to understand how it connects to the bigger picture. And I do think that's actually what The Inventor does, that I'm sure if you've read Bad Blood, if you've, you know, if you read every story and remember all of like how that all fits together, there might not be a ton or even any new information, but just to have that story told in a compelling and concise way, I think is very valuable.
And visual way, you know?
Right. And just to see, yeah, just to see and hear her is, it sort of defies belief.
Yeah, it really is something. And her voice and her unblinking eyes, it's just it's a real treat.
Cool. Well, we can probably wrap up there. So before I let you guys go, I will just do a quick reminder that if you like this podcast, if you love the podcast, we would really appreciate it if you subscribed on Apple Podcasts, on Pocket Casts, or any other podcast app of your choice. It'd also be great if you could leave us a positive review in Apple Podcasts. Thank you so much for listening. Anna and Jordan, have a great weekend.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys. See ya.